Session number 17620, James Watts, Grill 6.
Mr. Watts, Reel 6. You were describing to me that you'd done this house clearing. What was the military or infantry training for clearing a house?
Well, first of all, you've got to observe what you're going to do. You've got to wait up. You've got to be looking at likely vantage points of the enemy. Now, you can't teach that at school of infantry. You can only teach that when you get into battle. But you can go through the process of certain drills, like you'll come to a door, you'll kick it open, one of you'll spray it inside or throw a grenade in, and then you'll dash in, give it the best machine gun fight and make believe you're shooting up whoever's inside, and then dash out again, and so on. And these things actually happened, you know, in battle, that's how you perform. But I can go back to an occasion when we were at School Aycliffe. We did an exercise on a little disused colliery village with two rows of houses, not many houses. And we would clear these rows of houses in the same manner that I've just described. And Lieutenant Anand threw a smoke canister through the window, and an old man come running out with his braces on. Some old folk were still living in it. I think those squatters, but we didn't know they were there. And so that was something that you forget about quickly.
The field work, attacking and defending, would be part of this training.
Yes. There was one particular exercise on Deepdale Wood, that outside Barnacle, on the road to the Bowes Museum, where Bowes Moor. And as we approached it, the objective, which was the front of a copse. Now, the copse would be bombarded with 25 pounders and mortars. Meanwhile, while that was going on, there would be machine guns opening up from the Vickers and the Bren guns, and we would advance to on the right hand side of a wall which ran up both sides of the wood. We would advance up the right hand side, and then when the barrage stopped, we'd all leap over the wood and we'd fan out right across the field and attack the front. And of course, we'd fire with our weapons to make believe. Now, the map that I first saw showed you all the trees in the wood. Later on a revised map after the war, it was just a few stumps. At the top of the wood, there was a sheep pen, a ring of round stones, you know, a ring of stones, in which the sheep were put to shelter them from the winter, or maybe to sort them out when the farmers take them to market. Now, we used to attack the sheep pen from way back, about 3/4 of a mile, and we would attack it as a company. The attack on Deepdale was a platoon. The attack on the sheepfolds would be a company. And of course, if you try to imagine that the whole battalion is being committed to an attack, it's one company that usually starts it off and then another two do the breakthrough. Now, the barrage would start about 100 yards in front, and then it would lift. By the time we got to the sheepfolds, the barrage had gone cleared, except for the last time we ever did that particular demonstration, and unfortunately we lost two officers and a number of casualties. That was our very last demonstration for the battalion.
And this movement towards the objective, Was that in the old First World War style of lines of moving in?
Oh, yes. Yes, a line of well spaced out. That was something which was always taught, don't bunch, spread out. You know, try to be about 3, 4, 5 yards apart and advance in a line and hold your line, you see. And on the top of the hill there, was, you could see all the officers, you know, with their glasses out looking at them, seeing what was performed.
You weren't taught then what you might call fire and movement, where you moved in rushes, rather than this line of advancing men.
Well, that's one of the first things you're taught, you know, at the School of Infantry. You hear a shot, might be an explosion, you might be just a shot. And the drill is down, crawl, observe, fire. Are you with me?
Yes, I'm thinking in terms particularly of an objective, whether it be a dug-in position or what it is. You have your advancing artillery barrage, but you are following it in the old traditional.
Yes, behind. Yes, the Cretan barrage.
And certainly among the tactics that the Germans were to use was this small groups rushing forward.
That's right.
And this movement of fire, rush, then the next one fires and rushes and so on. That's and you're right. Covering each other as you move. But that wasn't taught.
No, this was an artillery barrage. We were taught the other things as well, you know, with small arms and
infiltration tactics.
Oh,
were they
yes,
taught?
Yes. The incidentally, this creeping behind the barrage. Later on, at the Battle of Casino, we were on the German troop before they could blink, and there were a lot of younger men there, young soldiers, just like ourselves, of course, and they were flabbergasted that, you know, we were there, and they were still dizzy and shaken by the barrage. We easy rounded them up.
So you moved very close to the barrage for protection initially.
Yes.
But when you actually hit the objective,
then we did our own thing.
Before they recover.
Right. You see, that type of thing, as I said before, you can't learn the proper thing until you're in battle. But when you're in battle, you know where the shots are coming from. You can identify by, first of all, the sound, it's over there somewhere, and then if he opens up again, you see the smoke of the coming off the bullets that have been expended. And then, of course, you organise your own little group, how you're going to take that out, so that your platoon commander can be telling his section commanders, now, right, get the 2-inch mortar on that machine gun over there, you lot, give them cover and fire, and then, of course, you would advance, you see, you would put... If you were advancing with your section, you'd say, right, bring gun over there, right, and fire at that, a likely place where someone could be, and then you would advance to another objective, and then the bring gun would move up, and then you would do the same, give them covering fire. So that, this happened all the time. We had to be looking out one for the other, not just look out for yourself. You've got to look out one for one another.
You said that there was the accident.
Yes.
How did that come about?
Well, as we were advancing in line, the 7th platoon was my platoon, and 8th platoon was on the right. And as we were going across, it was obvious what had happened. A shell hadn't, the gun hadn't elevated, and a shell dropped short, and it wounded Lieutenant Pestridge, who was commanding the platoon. And he was hit in the leg, and he sat on a big boulder, and we shouted across, are you all right? He says, I've been hit in the leg. So I went across to help him, and I was joined by a captain, I think he was a Captain Thompson of one of the Welsh regiments. And as we both ran across, the captain shouted, hit the deck, and we both hit the deck, and the shell dropped between the three of us. The wounded officer was instantly killed. Captain Thompson, I watched him die because he was wounded in the carotid artery in the throat. And I was just winded.
So that was the second shell that had dropped short?
That's right. That was the second one. And the number of the Sergeant Major Bowker, he was wounded. And one or two other lads were shell-shocked, you know, the blast. Winded. And very quickly, I just... pulled my wits together, and I said, well, that officer's dead, and that officer's dead. See to Sergeant Major, put your field dressing on him and that. And then, of course, we went back to barracks. I don't know what happened to their bodies, like. But that was the first time that I'd seen somebody killed by anything like that. And it never affected me while I was doing it and sorting things out. But going back to barracks on the transport, one of the lads says, "Are you all right, Sarge?" I said, "Why?" He says, "You're looking a funny colour." I did feel a bit ropey then, you know.
Was there an inquiry?
I don't know what happened. No, because you see, that was on the 13th of July. The 10th of August, we're on our way to Africa. So that was past history. But that officer, Eli's buried in Startforth Church, Pestridge. He's only 20, young lad. I'm still picture him.
And it must have affected, I mean, you've mentioned affecting yourself. It must have affected men, particularly his own platoon.
It did. It affects some more than others. But since then, death means nothing to me. I've overcome. It doesn't frighten me, death, because you're here and you're gone. And I often think of all the trials and tribulations you have when you're old, and you look back and say, that's the only knowing thing I have. Why me? Why wasn't I killed? And that happened once or twice in my life, you know, in my army career.
Have you any other memories of the camp in Bannercastle and your life there?
Well, deaths again. We had a wonderful lad, Corporal Aberdeen. Apparently, I wasn't there when it happened, because he was in another platoon. I think he was in 9 platoon. And he'd been running with the 2-inch mortar. You know, when you open the mortar, you've got the barrel and the leg, it forms an L. You can put it on the top of your shoulders, round the back of your neck, and rest on your pack. It's easier to carry. Apparently, he jumped across something, and as he jumped, the mortar went up and then hit him at the back of the neck, and he died in hospital. And that was a simple thing, accident. And there was another lad who I knew. He'd been brought up in Dr. Bernardo's homes. He lies buried in Barnacastle, Crossfield, I think they called him, Private Crossfield. And he was a nice lad, and he'd gone to Scarborough for a weekend, and I said, "What do you do when you go there?" And he said, "Oh, I go and collect seagulls' eggs and things for a friend of mine. He's got an egg collection." I said, "Oh, I've never had a seagull's egg." So about a fortnight later, he fetched me a seagull's egg. And I said, "Oh, that's good." He says, "You can eat them," but I did have it, but it didn't taste very nice. But it was a thing, and then I heard that he'd blown his brains out. To go and get that egg, he'd gone AWOL, and the punishment was he'd probably get 28 days detention or something like that. And he said that the colonel wasn't going to put him away, and he just shot himself.
Was there any problems within the battalion? I mean, you were very fit and healthy young men.
They were very fit.
Did this lead to aggressive behaviour from time to time?
No, not really. I think we were a good band of men, really.
There's no bullying?
No. I think we were a good band of men because we'd been taught well. You see, that was our university. 18 to 23, you know, in the army, most of us. That 5 years, a lot of people were enjoying going to university. I remember one person in particular, she would be going to university and learned to be a chemist, and she became Prime Minister.
So within the battalion itself, you were a good band of men, as you say. There were lots of camps around Barnardcastle. Did
yes.
that lead to problems between units, particularly on Saturday
Well,
nights?
You'd have your usual skirmish, and it was 6-2 and one of the other. I think one of the things that I remember that always makes me smile was the ingenious methods they had that lads did to escape home, you know, the getting home, travel book she as far as possible. So we're coming back from Darlington one night, and we're sat in this carriage, not a corridor carriage, remember, the old-fashioned carriage which could seat about 8 or 10 people, maybe 12 if you squeezed in. So as we approached the point where we were going to get off the train, it was Brummelow Station, a little station, I think it was especially erected for the Bose family, the Queen Mother's relations. Anyhow, as we were approaching this, there was a little lieutenant sat opposite me, and he said, "I hope you lads all have your tickets." It went quiet, because there's a picket waiting for you on the platform. So those of you who haven't got a ticket better follow me. Lieutenant. I believe his dad was a brigadier, I'm not quite sure. And we went out the other side of the carriage, and he led us up the wood and back to barracks. We were all there. But I don't think any of us had a ticket.
Did you work with other units? I'm thinking particularly of, well, army units in your training, but also the RAF and tanks, this kind of
thing? Yes, with tank regiments, with the Churchills. One of the features that I'd been taught when I was a private at Aycliff was a Brengel carrier would go over a slight hill, like so, and a slit trench was dug at the back, and I was in that slit trench. And the Brengel carrier used to go over the hill and then drop forward as it got on the crest, run over the top of the slit trench, and I would jump up from behind and stick a bomb on it, a sticky bomb. That's how he knocked tanks out. Well, later on, with me being little and nimble, I used to go in a Churchill tank, and the Churchill would, in a demonstration at Scargill, on one particular occasion, it would turn so that it was flat on, sideways, to the audience. Meanwhile, the little trap door at the other side of the tank would open, and I would get out with the brain gun and start opening up. And the officers said, "Where did he come from?" I had the Churchill tank run. Well, there was a few of us. The Churchill tank ran over us, but we had to dig our slit trenches in a certain way so that the tracks, you know, because you know, do you know that if you lie in soft ground, right, a tank can actually run over you and not necessarily kill you. It just flattens you into the ground. I wouldn't like to do that, mind. I think one of the things, the features of the tank going over the top of the slit trench, this was the same when we were in battle, as the tank goes over you, it's like a dragon breathing fire on you. You know, it's quite, you're glad when it gets over. And another feature of the tanks while we were on it, some lads of the tanks, you know, used to go to sleep under tanks in battle. And they used to sing during the night. There's quite a few lives lost like that.
Infantry tank cooperation, did you train in that?
Yes, well, but there was we didn't train, we demonstrated.
Demonstrating that.
But you see, the demonstration was out training. And of course, when later on, that was put into practice.
What was the basis of infantry tank cooperation that was being taught, that you were demonstrating at that time?
Well, a tank can move forward into country. And it can be so intimidating that it can collect a lot of prisoners. Now, a tank cannot round up prisoners, so you need the infantry being so close support. This was a German tactic. This is the Blitzkrieg. That's what the infantry move up quickly. Sometimes in the infantry, you're not too keen on tanks being present because somebody's looking for them. And if they throw it over there, well, they hold down or inside armour plate, and you're not, you're on in the open or in a slit trench. So we weren't too keen on having tanks beside us, as we weren't too keen with heavy mortars or 25-pounders or other artillery, because the enemy are on the lookout for them too, you see. You can easily dig a hole and get away from it all, but if big shells are dropping around, one of them might seek you out.
Were you demonstrating, training in a tank battle where the tank came under fire and it was only the infantry that had to go in to effect to get rid of that fire?
No.
Anti-tank weapons against tanks?
No, I think...
The tendency was, of course, the tanks are stopping the infantry go through, wasn't
that's it? That's right. You see, I think most of the things we did at the demonstration battalion was that we advanced in accordance with the artillery. But when the tanks are in association, then you've got three considerations. You've got to be watching the artillery who are there, what they're supporting. But tanks in the main, they're always, I think there's still a comfort to the infantry, even though you might not like them beside you. We used to say we wouldn't like your job, and they used to say, well, we wouldn't like yours, you know. But, no, we didn't do too much work with the tanks.
You didn't do work where the tanks, in effect, acted as artillery and fired you into a tank.
That's right.
Did you do that kind of work?
Yes. But the we went to June, July 1942, July 1943, we're finished with the School of Infantry. But I think at that point our battalion was must have been very, very highly trained and battle-wise. Although they hadn't been in battle, I think they'll be battle-wise. I know myself when I first went into action, some of the old soldiers who had fought in North Africa and Sicily before, you know, I don't think they were as steeled as I was, but I soon became like they were, man.
Did you work with, again in the School of Infantry situation, did you work with the RAF on close support?
No. That happened when I eventually saw action. Yeah. The Desert Air Force. Very good. And the American Air Force.
How did you get on with the people of Barnard Castle?
Not much. I didn't go into Barnard Castle much. I didn't go into Barnard Castle much at all. I was trained to be a soldier. I didn't have any social activities. There wasn't much in Barnard Castle that interested me, really. I once or twice went to Darlington. Oh, yes, I went into a theatre in Darlington. I don't know why, but the manager of the theatre singled me out personally and put me in a box in the theatre, and a comedian came on and cracked the door, and he said, by the time we get that done, he says, that lad up there will probably be a general. And the searchlight came on me. I didn't know where to put my face because I didn't know what was going to happen, you know.
I'd been planted.
I'd been planted, Brian. Well, I wasn't wise to these things, man. I mean, some of us we hadn't have any gills. I mean, we weren't wise at all.
Any other things that the battalion did whilst it was in its School of Infantry role?
Yes, it trooped the colour at Bowes Museum in the grounds. And unfortunately, I happened to be away on a course at the time, so I missed it. The Colonel, Jeffries, had gone and had been replaced by a World War One veteran, Colonel Fillingham. Now, he was quite an eccentric. I remember in March 1943, he presented a company of the Irish Guards with the shamrock. They, in turn, presented him with a thumbstick. You know, it's like a billiard cue rest, you know, on the top. And it's about 5 feet tall. Now, if you caught any soldier bending down in a very military manner, he'd whack his backside. I believe he did that to the RSM, and the RSM bore a butt of testimony for about 3 or 4 weeks. But he was eccentric, and he got us to put on Henry V. I was interested in that, but I had to go to the Northern Command, the Fieldcraft School, Advanced Handling and Fieldcraft School in Llanberis, which I believe was a punishment for what I'd done earlier in disobeying an order. I went to the command school, and there, of course, I learned the commando tactics. You know, this was highly skilled. This was the commando and the paratrooper type of training, which was very, very intensive. And I learned to handle explosives, all sorts of things, you know, which...
Unarmed combat?
Oh yes. Oh, well, I learned that at the PT school as well when I was a PT instructor. I taught unarmed combat. Now, that's a point. Unarmed combat. There was a little chap, only 5'4", but he was a warrant officer in the APTC at the Northern Command PT school. Swainston, they called him. Just a little chap. and he picked four of the biggest men on the course, and he planted them one on each side of a big mat, and told them to all attack him at the same time. And in the twinkling of an eye, they're all flat on the floor. He was so quick and deft. I mean, I could never reach that standard. But I did teach it. I did teach in armed combat.
Was this whilst with the battalion in Barnard Castle that you did?
That's right. That's right. I went.
So you'd been on a course, had you?
That's right. I went on to the on the APTC. I became a qualified instructor in PT. I remember that particular warrant officer saying, "Now, if you get hold of a man like this," he says, "you'll break his neck in 12 seconds." And he said, "Right, come here." He says, "Now I'm going to get hold of you and I'm going to put this grip on you." Well, he put the Nelson on me, that's what it was. And he says, "Now, but I want them to count four." He says, "If you feel yourself going," he says, "you've got to kick me. Understand?" I said, "Right." Well, he didn't count. I didn't hear you count to four. I was kicking after about two. And I said, "Oh, it works." But that was quite a thing. Well, at the Northern Command PT school, we ran 2 miles in 16 minutes with full kit on York Racecourse. If you didn't run in that time, you'd be returned to unit, RTU, which of course is a disgrace, you know. You don't get returned to unit. We ran 10 miles with full kit in an hour and 45 minutes.
What do you mean by full kit?
Well, FSMO, you know, not all your kit, not with your kit bag and everything, just the battle dress, you know, when you go into battle.
The pack on
just
the back?
Just a small pack, your gear, you know, what you normally have. And I remember when we were out doing that particular run, the 10-mile run, we came to some traffic lights in York. And, of course, whilst we were at the traffic light, it was hop, 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 running on the spot, you see, until it changed. And there was about six Yorkshire women went past and said, "Leave the poor lads alone, you so-and-so," which of course made them take it more out of us, you know. I had to carry, you know, in the army you often get the, you might get the order, tallest on the flanks and shortest in the centre. Well, there's also a pair off. So what happens is you pair off, but there's always a big one and a little one. Well, I had to, at 8 stone, had to carry a man about 14 stone, a sergeant out the rifle brigade. He had all his kit and I had all my kit. We had to carry each other around the veranda in the railway gymnasium. That was the London North Eastern Railway gymnasium where we had our course. We had to run round the veranda 200 yards in 2 minutes. Well, he flew around with me and broke the record, and then I had to carry him. Well, I think he was keep putting one of his legs on the floor. I managed. I wasn't RTU'd. But there was another occasion when we had to climb over, I think it was a 6-foot-6 wall, and we had to bounce up and get on the wall. Well, you had to have your respirator at the front, properly dressed. Whether you want to be properly dressed in battle or not, that doesn't matter, but this... on this, you've got to be properly dressed. Well, I had this respirator on my chest, and I twice tried to get over that wall, but each time I just couldn't get the bottom of the respirator to rest on top of the wall. So I took the respirator off and I slung it and I got over the wall, and the staff instructor said, "Improperly dressed, RTU'd." And a voice like thunder came out, and it belonged to an RSM power. He was the senior NCO in the course. And he shouted, "If he was getting his arse tickled by a German, he would get over there. And no matter how he gets over, as long as he gets over," he says, "give him extra points, RTU'd."
So you did attend a number of courses whilst you were at Barnard Castle.
That's right.
The commando course, the PE...
The PE course was the first one. The second one, I said, was probably a punishment.
That was... Where was that?
That was the Llanberis in North Wales.
Commando...
That's right. Well, I mean, we ran 20 miles round through Betsy Coed, etc., to get to the bottom of Mount Snowdon, and we would go up the mountain, and we would only drop about 3/4 of a mile into the camp. We got so far up the mountain, and the officer says, "I'm sorry, lads, we can't go any further. It's too windy. I'm not going to risk it." So we doubled the 20 miles back again. So we ran 40 miles between about 5 o'clock in the morning to 12 o'clock noon.